Hi, I'm Ted Price from Insomniac Games. On today's episode of The Game Maker's Notebook, I spent time with Harry Krueger, who's the game director at Housemarque. Harry and Housemarque recently shipped the brilliant game Returnal. We talked about how Housemarque embraced an organic creative process during development. We went deep into gameplay design decisions driving the game's procedural construction and combat, and we had a lot of fun talking about the challenge of randomness in a roguelike. Please join us.
Welcome to The Game Maker's Notebook, a podcast featuring a series of in-depth one-on-one conversations between game makers providing a thoughtful, intimate perspective on the business and craft of interactive entertainment. The Game Maker's Notebook is presented by the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, a member-driven organization dedicated to the recognition and advancement of interactive entertainment.
Well, Harry, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Ted. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
And I got to say, congratulations on Returnal. I've had so much fun playing it. I'm a roguelike fan, and your combo of the roguelike mechanics, awesome guns, and horror sci-fi really hooked me. And awesome. I've had trouble stopping playing it. And I know a lot of people feel that way. So it's really nice to have you on the show. And we can talk a lot about Returnal today and hopefully also about you. And I'm very personally interested in how you got started and whether you were an avid arcade player growing up.
Yeah, I think there are some telling signs that I might have been inspired slightly by some of the classics. I grew up, of course, in the 80s and early 90s. So I spent my most formative years in Greece, actually. And I was fortunate enough to have quite a few of the latest and greatest kind of arcade games around there, you know, at cafeterias, at hotels, you know, all of these kind of odd places that you'd go in some weird room they'd have in the back, you know, with five cabinets there. And it would smell of cigarette smoke. You know, that was kind of the vibe back then. And yeah, you'd have everything from like, you know, Ghosts and Goblins, like Robotron, you know, Pac-Man, Rygar, Rastan, Street Fighter II later. I mean, you know, I could go on. But those were really defining in shaping up a lot of my creative sensibilities, I guess, growing up. And of course, when I landed at Housemarque many years later, it was kind of like the perfect storm in a way. So it was the perfect fit of this creative sensibilities to take some of those ideas and just, you know, push them a bit to the next level.
What was your favorite arcade game as a kid?
Oh man, now it's going to be tricky. I think it varied from time to time. I mean, there were quite a few on rotation, of course. Bubble is one of my favorites of all time. So I spent quite a few quarters or drachmas back then, I guess, on that. Rygar is one of my favorites as well. Dodonpachi, which came a bit later, that's been quite influential as a shoot 'em up. And yeah, Robotron, of course, as you know, Next Machina was directly inspired from that. So that was really, really influential as well.
I can still hear the respawn sound in my head on that game from that game.
Oh, it was beautiful. Yeah.
I mean, it's just such a, I mean, that game and a few like it were so simple, yet they use these amazing mnemonics in the game that would just kind of pull you back. I thought like audio and mnemonics almost. So maybe that's not the right word, but for me, growing up, arcades were magic. I'm glad. I mean, it's really cool. I haven't talked to anybody else on the show who's really talked about their experience in arcades as a kid. So as a question, you know, since we're maybe older than the average gamer today, do you think that this word arcade is even relevant to some of the new gamers coming into games in general?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think clearly the concept of an arcade, like a standalone dedicated cabinet that you pay money to have one credit on, clearly that's a concept that hasn't survived, sadly. Maybe in some countries, I think Japan still has a somewhat active arcade scene, but clearly everywhere else, you know, you might see the occasional kind of, driving sim or, you know, some one forgotten cabinet somewhere, just as a distraction, but there's clearly not that much momentum on that space anymore. But I think a lot of the creative choices that those games made, they still resonate quite strongly, I feel. So from my perspective, even looking at the previous Housemarque games, it's never been about a nostalgia trip. It's never been about just taking the old and giving it a new coat of paint. It's about identifying what are the timeless gameplay values that resonated with me back then, and how many of those actually are still relevant today, you know? And just that feeling of commitment to a run that you get with an arcade game, you know, you put your quarter in, you feel like, you know, there's money at stake. So if you lose, you are going to lose your money as well. So you have this inherent investment in a run that, you know, it just makes the experience feel that much more engaging and special in many ways. And I think the design also needs to be fairly accessible. I mean, you need to addict players, right? You need to get them hooked as soon as possible. So it needs to be accessible but deep, you know, and it needs to have a bit of that scoring kind of layer there to just encourage a bit of that competition. You know, back in the day, you'd have the arcade heroes and you'd have everybody kind of gathering around them and just quieting down as they're about to make an all-time high score. And yeah, I think a lot of those creative sensibilities definitely have survived. And in many ways, if you look at, for example, the Souls-like games, when I, you know, many years ago when I played Demon's Souls, for example, on the PS3, it did feel to me almost like a modern reincarnation of those kind of creative values, you know, that uncompromising commitment to just that loop of just having a rock solid challenge and just hitting your head over and over on that until you eventually prevail and getting that feeling of satisfaction that you do as well, you know. So still relevant in some ways, but I think the presentation, of course, and the packaging has changed quite a bit.
Well, it seems also that for your games and for roguelikes in general, you also keep something usually after every death, which is a little different than the days when we were putting drachmas or quarters into arcade cabinets. Like, we, as you said, we got to keep our high scores maybe if we made the list, but you didn't come back and respawn with something that was useful for the next run, which is, I mean, to me, that has been the magic of roguelikes. You act, there's always something that you bring back from death that may help you on the next run, which is interesting. And I got to ask you as the expert, because I'm not an expert, you know, how did roguelikes evolve? And how did Housemarque sort of enter that arena and influence it?
Yeah, that's an interesting trip down memory lane there, I guess. So I think in some ways, like roguelikes for us, I mean, there were quite a few games. If you go back to the traditional kind of the original rogue, of course, right? And the more hardcore kind of roguelikes. I think the correct terminology for games like, you know, Binding of Isaac and Dead Cells and even Returnal is technically roguelite. With a T,
yeah,
because that has like the permanent progression, and they're a bit less hardcore, I guess, than the roguelikes. But yeah, I think it was a combination of a lot of different influences that came in, and in some ways, it was just the kind of pursuit of ultimate replayability, kind of that we had internally. And again, going back to those arcade values and just, how do you make an experience feel addictive and keep you coming back for that one more go? You know, how do you make it accessible yet deep? And I think roguelikes inherently have that kind of characteristic built into their design, you know, because every time you play, there's something fresh, there's something different, and it's really engaging. You know, there's like a world of possibilities opening up in every session. And there was something, even with our previous games, we have explored, let's say, some light randomization layers, right? So even if we look at a game like Nex Machina, which is very kind of rigid in its level design and number of enemies and flow, it's like the density of content is always the same, but the positions of the enemies and, you know, where the humans are going that you have to collect, those are slightly randomized as well. So in a way, it kind of prohibits autopilot. You know, you always need to be on edge and always need to be alert of what the game is throwing at you. So in a way, it was kind of just taking that sensibility, that kind of that thinking of creating this engagement and replayability, and just pushing it a bit further now, and you know, seeing how the roguelite games out there have accomplished this, and just putting our somewhat more unique spin on it, I guess, in the process.
Mm-hmm. Well, you absolutely have with Returnal, and I see a lot of influences from, you know, just the gaming industry in general, and but you have pushed the genre forward, which is fantastic. And I want to go back a step and just ask you, what is your favorite roguelike or roguelite? What are the games that, as you have, you know, grown as a director and somebody who's overseeing a game, have been drawn to and find yourself playing again and again?
Hmm. Yeah, I think out of the ones that I played, I'm sure there's many that I've overlooked, sadly. But I'd say probably Dead Cells maybe is the one that I've spent the most time on. There's something there about that really satisfying kind of core game feel that it has, with like the platforming and the forward momentum and the kind of elegance that it has with its core moveset, that felt kind of familiar, I guess, and something that we aspire to achieve with our games as well. So that made the core loop, like even putting all of the randomization and the roguelike stuff to the side for a moment, just the core loop of just jumping, running, engaging with enemies, you know, that was always fun to do. And I think that was kind of like the main hook for me, that the core gameplay was so satisfying that it just kept pulling you forward. And then as you get pulled forward, you discover more randomization, more surprises, more roguelike elements in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think that I pretty much just described Returnal there as well, I guess, with that sentence. But I was a similar thinking that, you know, whatever random bells and whistles we put in the game, the core gameplay, the second-to-second game feel needs to be just, you know, seamless and consistently satisfying. Because that's what will keep players coming back, ultimately, I feel, you know. Just that satisfying feeling of just killing one enemy and then the next one, collecting the obolites, bringing up your adrenaline, you know, just getting into that flow. And before you know it, hopefully, you know, you've been engaged and hours have gone by.
Yeah, and I absolutely feel that way playing Returnal, for sure. I mean, you definitely create a sense of flow. I think it's an excellent descriptor of what happens as soon as you step in that first portal, let's say on your first 50 run-throughs, or 50 after your 50 deaths. It gets to be a rhythm where it's broken up by the variety in your sort of level construction, by how you're mixing things up, and the enemies that you throw at the player, which to me it's a great combination. But you know, I also, one of the other things that I have wondered about and when playing is sort of your outside of game influences. And I've read interviews where you've talked about Lovecraft, and you've also talked about the new weird, which is a term that I had never heard before, or somebody I know has mentioned that, meaning authors like China Miéville, Jeff Vandermeer. And I've seen, are those for you personally something that you're interested in, that literary genre?
New weird wise, I'd say that wasn't necessarily something that's strongly on my personal radar. I mean, I know that, you know, we have a narrative team now, and there are a lot of similar kind of influences there in the team. But yeah, for me, it was always a bit more thinking outside of games. I think, you know, Lovecraft, as mentioned, has been a pretty big inspiration. Just that sense of cosmic horror of the unknown, and how it affects kind of the mind as it attempts to comprehend the incomprehensible in a way. Mm-hmm. So that was always really fascinating for me. I think when it comes to film as well, something like David Lynch has actually been a massive inspiration. And I know it's kind of an odd thing maybe to say in relation to Returnal, because I think it's just the surreal elements that Lynch manages to achieve, and this kind of dreamlike or often nightmare-like ambience, you know, where the dividing line between what's real and what isn't real just gets completely, you know, destroyed, and you're left always kind of like second-guessing and looking for layers of meaning in every scene. And I think that was, you know, one of the biggest influences, I think, in terms of just embracing ambiguity for Returnal, just embracing the mystery, you know, and not feeling perhaps obligated or even compelled to answer all the questions that you might have as a player. So I think many times, like, okay, I think we can all appreciate, of course, a well-told kind of story. I mean, we all like the hero's journey, and kind of we all want to see the, you know, the bad guy gets what's coming to him at the end, of course. And there's an inherent satisfaction in that kind of story structure. But I think what lingers the most is when you have mystery, and when you leave some things a little bit maybe incomplete at the end as well. And our goal with Returnal was ultimately to haunt the player. That was the number one goal from the beginning with the narrative. And just making sure that even after the credits, you'd have something lingering there, some questions, some kind of, you know, that bittersweet melancholy, that kind of uncertainty of what's next, you know? And then it becomes a lot more personal. You know, it's not something, it's something that's kind of your very own as an experience to cherish, you know? And then, like, the way that you interpret things, the way that you piece together these puzzle pieces that we've provided with players, that's also like a personal engagement aspect. It becomes a bit less passive in a way in terms of storytelling, and more active, because you're actively filling in the blanks to try to make sense out of this mystery. So yeah, that was definitely one of the biggest inspirations there when it comes to Lynch and cosmic horror. I think, of course, lots of other movies, you know, it goes without saying, a lot of the classic, you know, sci-fi horror movies, always been a big inspiration, of course. But, and of course, lots of games. But yeah, I think those are kind of like the biggest influences outside of games, I guess, that we can look at.
Well, you mentioned story, and how did you approach laying out the story and the overall design? Did you do them in parallel? Did you did one come before the other? What is your approach? What was your approach on Returnal?
So when we first started the planting the seed of Returnal, this was like close to 5 years ago, I guess, when we started putting together some ideas. You know, we just dared to dream in a way, just started collecting different ideas that resonated with us, right? And as I mentioned, you know, big fan of dark sci-fi, cosmic horror, a time loop, you know, and all of these things just came into a melting pot in a way. And we came up with this story of course, that the astronaut kind of crash landing on a hostile alien planet and getting caught in a time loop, as we know. And that was kind of both the setup for the story and also for the gameplay, that every time that you wake up, the planet is different, you know? And that was already kind of like intended to be acknowledged by the main character, like in this case, Celine, that the roguelike aspect and the time loop combined and what toll they take on her sanity, you know, as she just keeps going deeper and deeper. So in a way, both gameplay and story, they were envisioned to be inseparable from the very beginning. After that, I think the creative process involved just a lot of, you know, running wide with exploration. I tend to, you know, just anything that resonates with me, I just tend to kind of mark it down, like sometimes just mentally, but other times I might just, you know, I have like a text file and, you know, some image references that I collect over time. And it's kind of like just following your inner compass of the rule of cool in a way, you know, like if something is creating emotions for you, it's worth holding on to that. You know, there might be something there. And over time, I mean, this process takes, of course, months in a way, but you collect a lot of the raw materials and you just have all of them there laid out on this big kind of workbench in a way. And then it's just following the process of distillation and cutting away things that aren't fitting. And then, you know, finding like a few pillars, a few central kind of narrative beats in a way, and then just working backwards from there to fill in the blanks as we go. So it wasn't really a process of just starting at the beginning and just making one incremental step at a time to kind of advance the story. It was a very kind of organic process. You know, the ending of the game, which, you know, I won't probably best to not spoil here, But that came very shortly after the project was started. That was kind of clear. So it's like, in a way, you had the two bookends, like the beginning and the end, and then it's kind of just filling in that creative space of within those boundaries in a way. And then, yeah, over time, of course, then we built a narrative team, of course, for the first time ever. They came in with their own ideas, and yeah, we just kept working on this over and over, refining and ultimately cutting a few things towards the end as well. And the result is what you play with Returnal now.
Got it. Well, that's a different process than I envisioned. I think that's really useful to hear. You also mentioned that you developed the pillars or discovered the pillars along the way. What were the pillars?
In a way, just purely for the narrative, I think the main driving force was mystery, of course. So we just wanted to create, to have a story that's driven forward by asking questions, by being curious, you know. And that curiosity can turn to obsession sometimes, and that's where a lot of the magic starts happening in a way when you're that engaged with the story. But haunting the player, I think even internally, when we spoke with our narrative team and, well, with the team in general, one common question that comes up is, is this something like entirely inside Celine's head, or is it really happening, you know? And I'd always say that's exactly the kind of questions I want players to be asking when they play the game, you know? So in a way, it was just about accepting, embracing that ambiguity, accepting that there are, you know, that there might be multiple ways to interpret certain symbolic things that we're putting into the game, and just building the game around that kind of thinking. And it was just it's kind of difficult to remember exactly. I have like a vision document and like a mind map that I put together that just, sometimes you'd get an idea for a boss, for example, and you just kind of add that there. It's like, yeah, this is going to be a cool boss, and I don't know where it's going to go yet, but it needs to be, you know, a musician playing an organ and stuff, something like that, right? And then kind of like the Greek mythology, it's like, yeah, well, Selene, and there's like the Helios spaceship, and these kind of elements, they came organically as well. And that was kind of like a really rich avenue to explore a lot of these symbolisms and, cosmic horror kind of undertones, and just give it a bit of that fresh flavor as well. And, you know, we have the house sequences, like the first person ones. Those go into a little bit more Lynchian territory, perhaps. And, you know, you have a lot of that embracing the surreal and these kind of really strange, enigmatic sequences happening. And a lot of those beats just came, again, just almost like stumbling upon them. It could be just when theorizing about the game, or when you see a movie, or you could just read on, you know, a random article on the internet, and, you know, something speaks out to you. And because you're in that headspace of just exploring ideas, you kind of just grab it and, you know, you add it to that pile in a way. So, yeah, I guess that's always been the creative process in a way, for me at least.
So I got to ask a somewhat snarky question. When you have that organic brainstorming process and you're coming up with all these really cool ideas that you know will fit somehow, and you just got to make it work, and the team's going to work together to figure it out. How do you align that well with the production schedule when you have presumably milestones and a release date and other constraints within which you have to work?
Sure. So to be fair, a lot of this ideation happened during the pre-production, of course. So that's when we collected all the raw materials. After that, we came up with a plan that we thought was final, as it tends to happen. And after that, that final plan became final a couple more times, as you know, like that, as we had to scope down and readjust things and, you know, reevaluate some things that sounded great on paper, and then maybe they didn't work out in practice. So, yeah, but it does touch upon a fairly big topic, I guess, about our production in general at Housemarque. And, you know, this game was in development for around 4 years, give or take. And during that time, we also grew quite aggressively as a company as well. And in many ways, it felt like we were jumping into the unknown. Mm. So it's like we just jumped off the cliff, and we were confident that we'd build our parachute as we were falling, in a way. And, you know, it all worked out at the end, of course. And I think the vision of the game was fairly clearly defined from the beginning in many ways. But along the way, there were quite a few challenges and growing pains that we had to overcome. And, you know, making sure that we match the schedule, just to go to your original question, that was just one out of many questions, one out of many challenges that we had to overcome, I guess. But if you think about it, I mean, we start out, we're making a AAA, or let's say we're making a third-person game with high production values for the first time ever. And even just taking one of our previous games like Alienation and giving it the third-person treatment would have been more than an ambitious enough endeavor for us, right, in a way. But on top of that, we thought, hey, why don't we add procedurally generated content to the mix and the roguelike? Again, something that we haven't had experience with before. And first time telling a story as well. So that was a brand new thing to do, combining it with the roguelike, with the third person, with all of these new things. We were also doing it with an engine that we were largely still coming to grips with Unreal Engine 4, with an ever-growing team, you know, and of course having to collaborate with, you know, a lot of external partners and outsourcing to a degree that we hadn't done before. And towards the end of the game, we had to do all of this during a pandemic as well.
Right.
So there were quite a few, and, you know, even internally, I mean, when you have so many changes, you identify early on that, look, these 10 to 15 people games that we're making so far, clearly that's not going to work. That's not going to scale as gracefully, right, when we ramp up. But then it's always a bit unclear what you should be changing and what you should be keeping the same, you know? And I guess we kind of changed so many things so aggressively that sometimes it became even hard to identify what was the original cause of some challenges we were facing, you know? Is it the scope? Is it the genre? Is it production? Is it processes? Is it the vision? Is it communication? You know, because all of these things were kind of uncharted territory for us. So, yeah, that made the overall process it was plagued with uncertainty in a way. And of course, creative work is always, by definition, defined by its uncertainty, I think, and a lot of doubt that we learned to embrace. But there was just so many layers of it with the production of Returnal. And if you look at the final package as well, it is a fairly, you know, unconventional mix of genres in some ways. So we didn't even have another game to just look at as a blueprint for this, you know, say, look, let's just do what those guys are doing. So we just had to, you know, to trust that this combination of things would work out in the end as well.
Well, that's a great point. And I love the fact that you said that you needed to learn to embrace doubt and get comfortable with the unknown. Right. I mean, the game is all about getting comfortable with the unknown thematically. But then you as a studio, sounds like you were diving into a lot of just brand new territory. And how did you foster that comfort with the unknown and help the team get to the point where they felt comfortable charging into the dark and not knowing what was waiting for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just reflecting on the journey now, I think even when you release the game, there's just moments before it goes out there, you're still going to be holding on to a bit of that doubt, you know, like, was this the right direction? Is it, you know, because you don't really have any guarantee of what's going to happen. I mean, when we had user tests, for example, you know, when you get like somebody giving the game a 10 out of 10, you're like, yeah, I get where that's coming from. But then when somebody gives it a 3 out of 10, you're also like, yeah, I kind of get where that's coming from as well, you know. So there was no real kind of guarantee in a way of what would happen in the end. And, you know, that uncertainty, it always sticks with you, I feel, to some degree. And of course, we worked hard to empower the team to find the best way to approach you know, giving creative ownership. And yeah, just keeping the game running, firing on all cylinders in many ways, because that was a new thing for us as well, that, you know, when you have like 10 people making a, a smaller game, you can survive with that kind of garage band mentality, where it's like even without processes, without really, even without a producer, you know, you can kind of just, with the raw talent that you have there of that group of people, you can just, you know, push through and create a product. But the more, and then that's how Returnal started as well. You had like a few people. The prototype was done by, you know, 5 people, I think, initially. And then we progressively grew and grew up to about 80 when we released the game. And yeah, in the beginning, it's like, you know, you can't do that much because you're short-staffed. You don't have that many people. Then all of a sudden you get like 10, 20 people, and you know, like, well, that creates more work in a way. For, you know, communication and, you know, managing kind of like that machine that you've created with so many moving parts now. And then we're like, oh, we need more producers. And then we have more producers. And then it's like, oh, we need more leads. And, you know, and it was kind of like a process of constantly adapting to what the needs of the game were. Because once again, we hadn't done this thing before. So we were kind of learning while running at the same time. And I think, you know, inherently, when there are these many changes, it is going to foster a little bit of doubt and insecurity, you know, in the team's mind. And, you know, from our side, I think the only thing we could do is just, you know, support the team, be positive with our messaging, of course, internally. And it was positive. I mean, this was perhaps a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for us. You know, it's always kind of easy to lose track of that. When you're kind of trying to fix that one bug or solve that one technical problem, it's like, guys, like we're already winning, you know, like we're already in a place to be working on a dream project for us. And, you know, with, you know, a large degree of creative freedom, amazing support from, you know, Sony, our publisher. And, you know, we should be just try to enjoy it, you know, try to just, you know, really make the most of it as much as we can. It's easier said than done, as you know. And I think towards the end, especially with Corona, that added yet another kind of X factor to the mix as well, where a lot of the progress that you make in terms of communication and just work processes, it gets kind of almost like a hard reset. And you have to almost like rediscover how to communicate, how to work with certain groups of people. And yeah, that was a bit of a blow to us as well, I must say. But I think everybody, of course, has felt that. And
yeah. Well, do you think anything has changed for Housemarque now that we're coming out of the pandemic and we've learned a lot about remote work?
Let's see. I think some things might change. I mean, for example, just how easy it is to actually get people working from home. I think that was one of the biggest things that before the pandemic, not only in the games industry, but in general, it was like, oh, this job definitely cannot be done remotely. And lo and behold, you can actually do it quite easily, apparently. But there is a cost associated with that, of course. So I think, you know, there might be some increased flexibility, for example, with allowing some people to work maybe from home on occasion a bit more. And not have kind of this expectation that everybody needs to be, you know, every day of the week just present at the office. It might open up some doors of flexibility there. But otherwise, I wouldn't expect any much bigger structural changes to result of the pandemic.
Yeah. Okay. I got to say that, not to pontificate, but it seems like the pandemic was sort of analogous to some of the challenges we faced during development. When you run into a problem and certain people will say, there's no way we can solve that problem. And then you have to solve it, right? And then there's always a solution somewhere, as long as people are willing to be open-minded and innovative and try things. And it seems to me that throughout, just coming back to Returnal, you must have tried a lot of different approaches, mechanics as you were going through. And one of the things that stands out to me, and it's been talked about a lot, but I want to bring it up, is difficulty, right? Mm-hmm. What are some of the early conversations you had around the game's difficulty as you were just coming up with the ideas and putting the basic parts in place?
Yeah, I guess that is a topic that I've seen maybe one or two people discuss online as well. a bit of a hot topic, I guess.
Yeah, and by the way, I want to share that I see it as a good thing. I think that sure. Maybe the better word is challenge. It's not difficulty. It's you present this really cool challenge curve as players are spending more time with the game. But I know at Insomniac, when we talk about our games and our audience, we're always wondering out loud, should this game be easy, or should it be sort of really broadly accessible, or should it be punishing? Where do we fall on this sort of broad ruler of difficulty?
Yeah, I mean, the opinions on this topic vary quite a bit. I think even internally, you'd hear some different opinions. But from my perspective, I've never had any problems just accepting that our games are just going to be hard. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think especially since we were endeavoring to create a roguelite experience, I think that is almost synonymous with that type of gameplay. So having like the zero to hero progression, this high stakes kind of permadeath in a way. Well, it's not fully permadeath, but you lose most of your session progress. And that was just something really easy to accept, that we are designing a challenging game. And it's not just for the sake of being challenging, of course. It's that fundamentally, I feel that is one of the most direct ways to make a game experience satisfying. And I think even if you look at our previous games, or going back to the arcade games that we were discussing earlier, I mean, the closer to that verge of frustration that you get when you're just trying to overcome a challenge, the more elation you feel when you eventually break through it. You know, you need to have a wall in a way to bang your head on before you can have a breakthrough in a way, almost by definition. So, and Returnal was the same. I mean, we just embraced that it is going to be fairly challenging. However, the main difference is that with our previous games, we did have difficulty modes, of course, right? And there, because you had a really linear kind of structured experience, it was maybe a little bit more straightforward to just tweak some values and, make that work at different difficulties. With a roguelike, every session is guaranteed to be unique. So in a way, that's kind of like your pressure valve, you know? If you keep feeling that, the game is hard, you can play it the next time and you might get a bit luckier. You might get that astronaut figurine earlier on. You might get your favorite weapon earlier on. And that can create this bigger kind of investment and this feeling that, look, this is a good run that I have now, and I'm going to overcome that challenge. And I think, ultimately, it's been really interesting to follow some experiences of people online as well, that the initial reaction is that this game is just impossible and just screw this game, and they throw the controller at the screen. And then, a few hours later, they pick it up again. And maybe after a few hours or a few days, they come back with this triumphant story of overcoming the boss. And, you can feel some really, really powerful emotions coming from that as well, I mean, I've seen, some streams or some short clips of people being almost like tearing up when they overcome a boss. Because it's just such a powerful feeling of relief and emotional investment. And that's the thing. I mean, that particular emotion and experience is not really something that you can get if the game feels achievable in the beginning, right? Yeah. It's not even about being easy, but about just feeling that it's a comfortable challenge, So you need to have that barrier, that feeling of like, no, this is impossible. Like, what the hell were these guys thinking? And then when you overcome that, it's almost like a big personal breakthrough. It's like, yes, I did it. And in many ways, that's the thing. Like, going back to what you were saying earlier about roguelites and how some of the permanent progress things, of course, persist across runs, and they help give you like a bit of a leg up. But ultimately, the biggest resource that carries over is player skill, You know? And that is kind of like with arcade games as well, going back to our previous example that, you know, you could argue that, you know, if you spend an hour or something, or, you know, probably closer to 10, 15 minutes playing like an arcade game and you get obliterated, that you've wasted your time. But realistically, you've actually gained quite a bit of knowledge and mastery of the mechanics. And next time you can get a little bit further. And I think that that journey of just becoming better as a player, of mastering the systems, of feeling like this progress that I'm making, it's something that I've earned. I think that's a really powerful emotion as well that, at least I seek to have in the games I play as well.
Well, it certainly comes through in Returnal. And I feel like a lot of that has to do with extremely tight core mechanics. And you've done a fantastic job, I think, with your weapons, with your movement, with the way the dash works. And I do want to talk a little bit about that and go deeper into some of your decisions. One of the things I know that at Insomniac we talk a lot about with third-person games is what happens off-screen and how do we make it feel good for players when there are enemies surrounding you and you're in danger, but you can't see them. So what was your, did you experiment a lot with off-screen enemy attack behavior and tuning how brutal they were as if they weren't in your view cone?
Yeah, great topic once again. Yes, we did do some exploration there. That's one of the new things we had to solve going to third person. So of course, with a top-down camera, you have a bird's eye view. You're in the center of the screen. You have a 360 perspective of bullets coming from all directions. And then all of a sudden you put the camera behind the character and you're like, oh, wait a minute. Like, there's like half of the space that I'm used to utilizing to create challenges is not visible to the player anymore. So yeah, we did experiment a bit there. I mean, we have the usual kind of like, ticketing systems between enemies and, how aggro they get depending on whether they're in your view cone or outside of it. However, we kind of reached this point also where, if you get too aggressive with that, it becomes a system that's really easy to cheese, because you can just keep an enemy off screen and just it's not going to shoot me because I've disabled it effectively now. Mm-hmm. And it's a really easy mechanic to learn to utilize as a player. So I think ultimately we did end up having some kind of minor adjustments there, like, having some slower, some ticketing systems that, maybe were a bit more dynamic in terms of just being a bit slower when enemies are behind you. And yeah, I think we, with the audio as well, it was about prioritizing kind of like the feedback that was most relevant to you. So, if you have two enemies doing an attack preparation, both in front and behind you, the one behind you would, of course, be more critical to kind of be aware of.
Right.
And it was just those kind of like minor adjustments in a way. But ultimately, we did leave the game to just breathe. I mean, anything the enemies do in front of you, they do also behind you, just with maybe some subtle constraints. Because I think that also creates a more predictable gameplay. It's like you see an enemy, you even if it's going to be off screen for a bit, you kind of already have learned that it's going to shoot fairly soon. And then right. With audio feedback and, we also have this helper threat indicator that you probably saw around the player. Mm-hmm. So that helps a little bit as well, just pinpointing a bit like the direction of incoming projectiles and like those expanding rings that we have and melee attacks. So those were the kind of solutions that we looked at. But ultimately, I think we just embraced that, there is going to be a lot of things happening and it is ultimately up to the player to learn to kind of prioritize their goals and pay attention effectively and strategize accordingly. I mean, if you feel most comfortable just, backing into a corner and shooting from there, maybe that's your strategy, If you want to just...
That's a fairly deadly strategy in Returnal, though. I gotta admit, I think that's a fairly deadly strategy and meaning deadly for the player. I found that I needed to keep moving pretty much all the time, but...
That's the secret, right? I mean, if you play too defensively, then you do literally back yourself into a corner and then you're kind of screwed. But the moment that you get a little bit more bold and play a little bit more aggressively, you start gaining more control of the situation. You start becoming the hunter rather than the prey. That's the feeling that you get. And yeah, it's interesting. I think there was kind of like a limit of how many things we could throw at the player. And, you know, because one of the problems, I guess, that we have to solve when we're doing design is you have this one resource that is the player's attention, right? And that is arguably the most valuable resource that you have. And of course, it comes in very short supply. So you know that if you're spending like, you know, 100% of your attention on one big, like, you know, bullet pattern coming from in front of you, you have 0% attention left to focus on the other 15 things. So it did come down to, you know, very meticulous kind of balancing and tweaking, like, you know, the size of the bullets, the size of the attack preparation effects that we have for things like, you know, a beam that will attack you really fast versus slow moving projectiles that tend to pollute the playfield, as we called it, and add like these more layers of avoidance gameplay. So yeah, I think things still get quite crazy quite a few times, but I think, as we mentioned, as a player, you do learn ways to overcome that. And if you prioritize the weaker enemies, for example, then you can automatically kind of clear up a lot of the projectile havoc from the gameplay space, and then focus more on the bigger guys, right? And so on. And there's multiple layers of strategies, of course, with like the melee and, of course, the hook shot that you get later and all of these layers. Just adding depth without complexity, I guess.
Well, absolutely. And it comes through. And I felt like you did a really great job of kind of gating that complexity as the player was getting more experienced, or not gating it, but just sort of adding to it. And I found maybe on my 20th death or so that suddenly the setups were getting a little bit more complex, noticeably more complex. The enemy mixture seemed to be slightly different. And maybe that was me just imagining it. But when you were tuning the game, were there certain gates where you would sort of flip a switch and say, okay, now we know that the player is accomplished enough to handle more complex mixtures or higher numbers of enemies versus at the beginning? And because since the game is all of the rooms are, I guess, procedurally generated, there seems to be so much randomness, right, that you could have employed. But it seemed to me there were patterns in the randomness that had a lot to do with my abilities as a player.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was an attempt to bring some order out of the RNG chaos, I guess. And there is some structure tied, of course, to your progression in terms of how far you are in the game.
Sure.
And yeah, it was, of course, designed in a way that the more you play, the more the game kind of opens up to you and adapts. Mm-hmm. But maybe not to the degree that you're alluding to. But that's kind of the beauty of RNG.
Yeah.
Right, that it's not fully random. I mean, we see patterns in RNG even as players, and sometimes you can feel like this game is intentionally trying to screw me over, which is not intentional. And other times you feel like, hey, the game is actually helping me out now because it sees that I'm struggling. Also, not fully intentional. So I think, yeah, it was about, of course, drip feeding some of these elements into the game. And you know, when you play, for example, the overgrown ruins at a more advanced level compared to the first time, that's the onboarding, of course, you are going to get a bit more front-heavy kind of distribution of enemies, and, you know, the reward kind of drops are like a little bit differently balanced there. So there is some progression, some evolution, I guess, of the game as you keep playing it. But ultimately, we were, again, quite comfortable with just letting the variation breathe.
Okay. You know?
And not trying to contain it too much, and just allowing those kind of highs and lows to just manifest. You know, sometimes you will get those runs that feel like everything is going against you, and that will make the next run where you feel like everything is running in your favor feel a bit sweeter as well. So I think that's how you get the maximum range of kind of highs and lows in the experience, I feel.
Well, I have to ask an even more sort of developer geek question, and it's about the randomness, because I felt like you did a really good job of avoiding repetition in a way. And it was great to feel that many of the rooms were familiar, right? I'd been to them before, but they weren't presented in a way that I felt tired of them. I wasn't seeing the same thing so frequently that it created fatigue. And I think the same goes for the pickups and the treasure rooms, where you're dropping down into those sort of big spaces where anything can happen. How did you tune that?
That's a good question. So I think, honestly, a lot of it just comes down to just having a large amount of content. So, you know, if you had only, like, for example, 5 rooms and you had to reuse those over and over, then the order that you present those would be critical, right? You know? But if you have, you know, like we had, like, was it 60 different rooms or levels or something like that, then you're pretty much guaranteed to just, if you press the shuffle button, it is going to feel very, very likely it's going to feel fresh. You know, you are going to get those rare occasions where you play 2 subsequent sessions and you're like, hey, this kind of feels, you know, somewhat similar to what I played before. But for the most part, you are guaranteed to get runs that feel unique. And it's the same thing with our weapons and with our, you know, with our artifacts and the parasites and everything. Like, once you discover these, I mean, when you first play the game and you only have, like, you know, 1 or 2 weapons in the pool, you are going to be finding only those 2 weapons. So there is going to be a little bit of that, you know, familiarity and maybe a bit of that repetition kicking in. You start feeling the hunger for something more. Once you have 10 weapons in the pool, then you start having the opposite problem. You're waiting for your favorite weapon to come and it's just not arriving, right? So I think, yeah, it is just about having that commitment to having a rich enough content, I guess, in all of those areas that utilize RNG that just create that fresh experience each time without the need to kind of control it too much, I feel.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does vary from biome to biome, of course.
Right.
So if you look at, for example, you have the overgrown ruins in the beginning, then you look at the Crimson Wastes, right, the desert, and that has a little bit more of a recognizable structure with, like, the 3 acts. So, you know, there we have a similar amount of levels that we're using there, but because we wanted to have this, like, 3-act theming, you might detect a little bit more kind of like familiar elements there than you would see, for example, in the Overgrown Ruins, which is just almost like a flat kind of like randomly connected group of rooms that we use there. So, and every biome, of course, has its slightly different, slightly unique kind of rules, I guess, to make it feel distinctive, I guess.
Okay. Well, thanks for explaining that. And also, since you mentioned them, I just want to share how cool the malignant items and the parasites were.
Oh,
and
awesome.
I'm just, the choice that you present the player every time you encounter one is maddening and exhilarating at the same time. Was it hard to tune those?
It was. I mean, I don't know about hard, but yeah, it did take multiple iterations, of course, to find a good balance there. I mean, sometimes, you know, the pendulum can swing in both extremes before it settles. And, you know, in the beginning, you kind of had, like, we might have had, like, some parasites that were so overwhelmingly positive that it was a no-brainer to pick it up. And then you push it to the other extreme, and then it becomes a no-brainer to just avoid them because the negatives are overpowering. So of having that right tension there between the pros and cons, that took quite a few iterations to get right, to be fair. But just like a lot of our content, we did, you know, we did dedicate happily quite a bit of time to get making those, that decision space, have the right tension. And, you know, there's like how you combine those as well. I think that's where, going back to your previous question about the randomization and how curated that is, I think that's where, you know, you might find a few combos that are a little bit more kind of manually defined because they make more sense to be combined as pairs. Whereas if you just allow a free-form connection between pros and cons, you might get, again, that kind of the pendulum swings to either of the extremes and you lose a bit of that tension. So
yeah. We
wanted to make sure that those are consistently, let's say, interesting decisions to make.
Yeah, I think you did a great job on those. It really felt like every time it was worth stopping and thinking hard about what I was going to do.
Awesome. Thank you.
So I have one more nerdy gameplay question, because I thought about it every single time I died. And that was there a point where you allow players to take more with them after death?
Let me think. Not really. No, I mean, you know, very, very early on in pre-production, I mean, we might have done some, you know, random prototypes, I guess, where, you know, there's, you know, some piggy banks that you put your currency in and, you know, it pays something out in the beginning of the next run and, you know, giving some kind of starting rewards to the player based on how they did in the previous run and things like that. But, and, you know, keeping some of your obolites, for example. I mean, we did experiment with some of those things early on. But, you know, the more friction we had with the game, the more we realized that, yeah, we just want to embrace that kind of purity of just kind of starting always from like zero with your pistol and like from nothing. And then just find ways to just deliver the content in a way that makes you kind of eager to see what the game has in store for you every time. But that was kind of an interesting kind of creative space to explore about, you know, how much of this stuff do you put into players' hands versus, you know, for creating your build, as they say, and customizing kind of like your run versus just feeling that you're a leaf in the winds of Atropos. And for the most part, the guiding principle from my perspective was that, look, we're making a roguelite. It's all about what the game has in store for you, what surprises and, you know, positive and nasty things it has in store for you, and we should just embrace that. You know, the more control you give the player over the destiny, the more control you take away from the world to define your destiny, right? So I think we explored some different kind of UI-driven kind of, you know, build shops where you'd kind of, you know, put some slots in and customize your character and have all of these nodes and, you know, these kind of things. And you know, those introduced quite a bit of complexity to the experience and not an equal amount of depth and richness, I felt, at least. So just trying to keep the experience streamlined and allowing like the game to just keep throwing new RNG things at you rather than giving too much agency to the player that even from a narrative perspective, it starts creating a bit of dissonance, you know?
Yeah.
If you keep saying that Celine is kind of just powerless and just is at the hands of fate or Atropos, I guess, the more you can kind of sit there and comfortably customize your character, it kind of takes away a bit from that, I felt. So, yeah, that was the reason we ended up where we're at.
Well, I'm glad you explained that because it all makes sense now. It didn't make as much sense to me because I wasn't thinking of it from the narrative perspective. But, yeah, I get it. And I think you're right. Totally agree. If you had been loading up the player with a lot of additional items, the story wouldn't have made much sense or as much sense. So it's very cool to see that marriage of design and narrative from the very start.
Awesome.
So looking back on this journey, is the game fairly close to what you had originally envisioned, or did it take on some unexpected shapes and forms that you hadn't envisioned years ago?
I think it is fairly close. Just trying to remember now. Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I was looking at some earlier screenshots of the game that we had when it was just 6 months old or 8 months old, you know, with us gray box levels and, you know, some spheres that were our enemies and, you know, those kind of like really, really early prototypes. And already, you could see that the structure of the game was already in place, you know? So like the compartmentalized kind of spaces, like the levels that we have connected with doors, you know, the mini-map, the, you know, the kind of randomized enemy encounters there, the randomized loot, So in many ways, I think that we established those things fairly early. Even the game feel, like the controls, you know, on the one hand, that can take, it takes a lot of effort for something to feel effortless, but the fundamentals were already defined and comfortably locked in place very, very early in pre-production. Now, it's kind of like, it was almost like a simple thing that we don't want to complicate this. You know, you want to have the most responsive kind of jump, the most responsive controls, weaving in and out of bullets, you know, fast and responsive feedback. The dash needs to be short and sweet and just feeling in control. I think a lot of these things we nailed fairly early, actually. And then, of course, we enriched with audio-visual feedback along the way. But long story short, yeah, I think it is pretty close to how I hoped the game would turn out. If you look at some of the original kind of pictures I had made for the game structure, I think it was quite different back then. So, you know, how I was talking about all of those random kind of cool ideas for like the narrative beats and like those high points. Clearly, though, not all of those had a clear home from the beginning. And, you know, I ran quite wide with like, you know, possibilities. And I think the very first version of the world structure I proposed had something like 15 different biomes.
Wow.
You know? So there was a bit of this naivety, I guess, that, yeah, guys, we could do anything we want, you know? There were so many possibilities. Again, not understanding the scope of work and effort a game of this caliber takes. And over time, that got distilled incrementally to the, you know, the six biomes that we have now and the two-act structure.
One of the wonderful things about this game so far is that there hasn't been a lot of nobody is, at least as far as I've seen, nobody is going, okay, let me tell you everything about the game. There's a really wonderful sort of unspoken commitment to keeping the conversation at a fairly high level. I think even in the reviews, in a lot of the comments I've read, so that people can truly jump in and experience it like you've been describing, which is, hey, we want you to feel like, we want you to ask questions along the way and really wonder what's real, what isn't, where is this story going, how is it going to end up? And I've certainly been surprised by some of the twists that I'm running into. So
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been wonderful reading up a lot of the theories online about the story. And yeah, I guess I don't want to say too much about that either, to not spoil things too much. But in many ways, that's what we hoped would happen, that instead of just having like one definitive kind of like, oh yeah, this is obviously what happened and, you know, case closed, that there would be some discourse and some kind of engagement, I guess, with the mystery of the story.
Yeah,
that would live even outside of the confines of the game in a way. You know, it's like you play the game, and then afterwards you go and have a drink with your buddy, and you just talk about the story in a way, and you theorize about the different interpretive strands. In addition, of course, to the gameplay related things and so on. But
that's a great point, and I feel like I've seen discussions about that as well. Sort of the why, you know, people going beyond sharing their gameplay experiences and having conversations about what things mean in a game. I mean, to me, it illustrates that you've succeeded in that narrative goal of yours, right, from the very beginning, and getting people to just wonder, and draw their own conclusions and then be able to compare them. I think that's a fantastic element of just games in general when you can pull it off, and you guys really have.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. It's really cool. Really cool to be seeing how positively the game has been received in general. And also, as you said, how players have engaged with the story and kind of like the mystery of the game itself, you know, just trying to understand its systems, discussing strategies for bosses, you know, how to overcome these obstacles, where to
find. I will say, I wish there were more, personally, I wish there was a lot more discussion about how to beat the bosses, because I tell you, those for me are, like you said, those are points where once you get past a boss, there is that amazing feeling, but getting up to those, you know, to that point, it's challenging, which is great, right? A very different experience than what I'm used to in most of the games I play. So kudos to you on that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And I think it is, it's kind of like when all the planets align, when you have that one session where, you know, you get a little bit further than you thought you would without losing as much health. And you have like that astronaut figurine in your back pocket and, you know, and you feel like, okay, this is, I have a good run going. This is my chance. And you get like really pumped up and you have this anticipation. And then you go to the boss and, you know, it crushes your spirit again. No, no, but that's when a lot of the magic happens. It's like you're building up to this moment of triumph, you know, and it will happen. You know, the game will favor kind of like the RNG gods in a way. And
it builds character. So,
yeah. No, because it's interesting, you know, about the anticipation as well. That goes back to the story. I remember reading this article that says that, you know, dopamine, like the pleasure hormone in the brain, it's actually released through anticipation. So that means that the morning of Christmas that you wake up, that you're thinking about what presents you're going to get, you're actually happier than the moment that you open them in many ways. And that was actually, I remember that being one of the bullet points when we were looking at the narrative and some of the gameplay stuff as well, that, you know, dopamine is released through anticipation, create anticipation. And I think with a narrative, at least, that was a bit more clear cut as a goal. With the gameplay, there are layers there, of course, that touches upon. But it was an interesting kind of narrative strand that came to mind that I wanted to share.
That's a fantastic insight. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Cool. Well, hey, congratulations on a fantastic game. I can't wait to see what you all do next, but it's going to be a while, I think, before I'm even able to play what's next, because I am still immersed in Returnal, as I know a lot of people are.
Awesome. So, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us. And once again, please share everybody's congratulations with the team.
Will do. Yeah. Thanks a lot for having me here, Ted. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for the Game Maker's Notebook. For more information on the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences, our podcasts, and our other initiatives, please visit www.interactive.org.